This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
There's an 80% decline in species richness in an oil palm plantation versus a forest that's been selectively logged.
The global expansion of the palm oil industry is one of the largest upheavals in modern agricultural history, and one that many Americans know nothing about. And yet palm oil is now everywhere in this country, in our food, our cosmetics, and someday soon, maybe even in our gas tanks. This week on Sea Change Radio, we learn about the palm oil explosion over the past two decades from Rhett Butler, the founder of the popular environmental news website Manga Bay. Butler discusses the social, economic, and environmental impact of this rapidly expanding crop in the tropical countries where it's grown, and what measures are being taken to mitigate the damage that a monoculture like palm oil can inflict. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Rhett Butler. He's the founder of Manga Bay. Rhett, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Bill, thanks for having me.
First, why don't you tell us about Manga Bay, why you started it, and what the organization's mission is.
So Manga Bay is an environmental science website. We report a lot on environmental news and conservation news and environmental science issues. It was really born out of my passion for tropical forests. So I started the site in 1999, and I've been doing it full time since 2004. And since 2004, it's really grown, and we now have a major presence in Indonesia. So we have Manga Bay Indonesia, which is all in Indonesian.
And let's turn to Indonesia right away, because I wanted to talk to you about the African palm oil explosion over the last decade and a half. Indonesia's been really one of the flashpoint areas for the palm oil explosion. Why don't you explain how that country's been transformed by palm oil since you've started going there?
Both Indonesia and Malaysia have seen this rapid expansion in oil palm plantations. And so palm oil is used in a wide variety of foods. And it's often used as a fat in processed food. It's used in cosmetics. It's used in soap. Sometimes it's used widely as a cooking oil. And the advantage is it's very cheap. And that's because you have a very high yield from the crop. And so because the crop is very high yielding, it's very profitable. And so what's happened is there's been large scale expansion across forest areas in Malaysia and Indonesia. And so in Indonesia, we're talking scaling up from roughly, if we go back 20 years, it would have been, 850,000 hectares to perhaps 8 or 9 million hectares today. So that's a tenfold increase in this acreage, and as it's expanded, it's not expanded in savannas. It's expanded at the expense of forest. And so there was a study that came out last year that showed that 90% of recent oil palm expansion in this part of Borneo took place at the expense of forests. So it's having a very significant impact in Indonesia and Malaysia as well. There's some major environmental issues with this. One of which, a lot of the most charismatic and threatened species are in Southeast Asia. And so as these oil palm plantations expand, it puts these species at further risk. So this would be creatures like orangutans, pygmy elephants, Sumatran and Javan rhinos, endangered Sumatran tigers. So there's a wide range of these charismatic megafauna that are now further endangered by this expansion. The other major issue is a lot of this forest lies on top of peat, and so peat stores a lot of carbon. And so when you drain the peat or chop down the trees for the oil palm plantations, it generates a lot of carbon emissions.
How exactly do monocultures affect endangered species adversely?
Well, so a monoculture, or like an oil palm plantation, is a really poor habitat for most animals, for most forest-dependent animals. So a palm oil company will tell you, oh, well, it's just like forest, but it's really not, because the only food around is the oil palm fruit, which very few animals actually eat. And you don't really have any of these ecological niches that you had before. So there are a few animals that do really well. So pigs, rats, small little leopard cats. But beyond that, you have a huge drop off of biodiversity. So there have been a variety of studies done over the last several years. And the average is something like there's an 80% decline in species richness in an oil palm plantation versus a forest that's been selectively logged.
So I was in Malaysia 2 decades ago, and it was a very different place, I imagine. I haven't been back since 1992. What would maybe strike me as different about Malaysia if I went back today?
Well, so it would depend where you are in Malaysia, but what's happened across the entire country is there's been about 150% increase in the acreage of oil palm plantations. So it's gone from about 1.9 million hectares to probably roughly 4 to 4.5 million hectares. A lot of that expansion in peninsular Malaysia happened in areas that used to be rubber plantations, but it also happened at the expense of forest. But in Malaysian Borneo, expansion has taken place almost exclusively at the expense of forests. And in areas where you would have gone in and you would call them rainforests, you would have seen wildlife all over the place, you now have oceans of oil palm plantations. So if you fly over in, say, Sabah, which is in Malaysian Borneo, if you fly over an area that would have, you know, that was forest 10 or even, you know, even 5 years ago, today it could just be oil palm plantations as far as the eye can see. And what's really crazy there is that they are doing oil palm plantations up hillsides. So these very steep slopes that you wouldn't think anyone would do agriculture on, they're now doing these oil palm plantations. And so anything you're adding to those oil palm plantations, fertilizer, pesticides, is all running down those hillsides into local streams. And so you have a lot of effluent and effects on aquatic ecosystems as well.
What are some of the measures that are being taken in a country like Malaysia to limit this seemingly never-ending thirst for palm oil product?
So some people in Malaysia would tell you there has been no deforestation for palm, because a lot of the deforestation is happening in areas that are zoned for agriculture. So back when the Brits controlled Malaysia, they zoned the country for different types of use. So there were forest reserves that were going to be for logging, and there were large areas for agriculture. And so those areas zoned for agriculture may have been covered with forest, but they were zoned for agriculture. So when they were converted, the palm oil industry will tell you that doesn't count as deforestation. So yes, Malaysia does have laws on the books that are much better enforced than, say, in across the border in Indonesia. But from an environmentalist perspective, it is still deforestation nonetheless. So the issue that Malaysia has now is it's running up against these, one could say, arbitrary limits of land that's available for palm expansion. So there are a couple of approaches to dealing with this. One is degazetting areas that have been set aside as forest reserves.
What does that mean, degazette?
So that means taking it out of the forest estate where the law says it has to remain as forest, and zoning it for conversion to agriculture. So that's been happening to a degree. But what's been happening even more is Malaysian companies are taking their intellectual property and their methods for producing oil palm or palm oil and expanding into overseas places. So a lot of the deforestation that's been driven in Sumatra and Indonesian Borneo has been Malaysian companies coming over, because they no longer have land for expansion in Malaysia, so they're building up land banks in other regions. That's also happening in Africa now. So there are very large Malaysian companies that are going into West Africa, Central Africa, and buying up concessions to do large-scale oil palm. So the interesting thing is that a lot of these companies have kind of evolved from logging companies. So back, if we had been talking about this 20 years ago, we would have been highlighting these Malaysian companies, timber companies, that were going to places like Guyana and Belize and logging forests for timber. Well, today those have been replaced by companies that are going in and totally clearing those logged forests and converting into oil palm plantations.
And outside of countries like Malaysia, Indonesia, and the Southeast Asian area, where is palm oil expanding rapidly as well?
So oil palm is expanding quite rapidly now in Africa. It's funny because oil palm originated in Africa.
And this type is called African palm.
Right. So there are two species, and they're both from West Africa. Traditionally, there's been a lot of oil palm in West Africa, but it's been done, it's been intercropped with, you know, other crops, other agricultural products. So these weren't monoculture plantations. They weren't intensive. You would do, you have an oil palm tree, and then you may have some coffee and some other, you know, cassava or something. So this, it's returning to Africa, but it's much more industrialized. It's not clear how productive these oil palm plantations are going to be, because when oil palm evolved in Africa, there are a whole bunch of pests that, you know, evolved to take advantage of it. So there could well be a lot of issues with pests and native pests that could affect these plantations. So there might be more need for pesticides and just pest control. But anyway, the plan is to, for these companies to go to Africa where land is cheap and expand there. So that's kind of the new frontier. There are still places in Indonesia where there's a lot of expansion happening. So Kalimantan, which is Indonesian Borneo, in New Guinea. So both the Indonesian side of New Guinea and also Papua New Guinea, which is an independent country. And then because it's just such a profitable crop, it's really expanding everywhere. So the Philippines is looking at investments. It's happening in Laos. Thailand's a big producer, and then Latin America. And so the big place in Latin America is Brazil. But Brazil's model for oil palm is very different from anywhere else in the world, at least today.
It kind of has to be within an equatorial band, I imagine.
It does. Yeah, right. So it is a tropical crop. You're not seeing it grown in, you know, in China. I mean, maybe far southern China, but it's not growing in the United States. But Brazil has a huge area which is suitable for oil palm. It would well dwarf the current global production of oil palm in terms of land suitability.
The river's so wide, the mountain so red, and with the sunshine over my head. The honky tonks are all closed and hushed. It looks like Palm Sunday.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with Rhett Butler, the founder of Manga Bay.
Can you give us an idea of the global production of oil palm and the evolution of it over the last decade, and how much oil palm can we potentially see being grown?
Palm oil production has really blossomed since 1985. So since then, there's been a sevenfold increase in global production. So we're now around 50 million tons a year of palm oil that's being produced. And that translates to 17 or 18 million hectares. 18 million hectares is roughly a third the size of California.
Wow.
And a lot of that has occurred at the expense of natural forests that's been converted for oil palm plantations.
Have we seen wild price fluctuations in the last decade as this commodity has expanded rapidly?
Yeah, so the price shot up from around $400 a ton roughly a decade ago to $1,350 in the late, you know, around 2008, 2009. There's been quite a pullback this year back to $800. But so yeah, there have been price swings. The issue for the palm oil industry is there's so much new production coming online that there is going to be pricing pressure. So Brazil has a target of 5 million hectares, up from 200,000 hectares for this decade.
That's like a quarter of the global production.
Exactly. Yeah. What I think will probably happen in this market is there will be downward pressure on pricing towards the end of this decade, which will probably trigger large-scale abandonment of some of the more marginal oil palm plantations. So the industry doesn't really talk about this, but if you're looking at this from sort of a social or environmental perspective, it's a big problem. I mean, of course, expansion's a problem, but when you have large areas of forests that have been converted for oil palm plantations and the oil palm plantations are abandoned, the forest doesn't just come back. You essentially have a dead landscape. The people who were thought they'd be employed on these plantations will no longer have jobs. They won't have food because it's not like they can go eat the oil palm fruit. So yes, while a price slowdown might be good for, you know, for reducing expansion, it's not really a good solution for anything. It's also a problem. So when you look at a country like Indonesia, which is converting these forests that are totally unique to Indonesia, all sorts of interesting wildlife, but also potentially commercializable plants. So when you're converting these things that make Indonesia unique into these plantations, which can be grown anywhere on earth, you're losing your option value. And if it turns out that the oil palm market declines further, you know, by half or whatever it is, you've essentially wasted all, you know, these unique resources for a crop that can be grown anywhere. So it's one thing that's not really looked at is the fact that it's really hard to go from an oil palm plantation back to this forest that has all this biodiversity, which has potential value.
And just from a pure economic strategic standpoint, it seems like one of the fundamental rules you always learn as a investor is to diversify. You shouldn't have everything in stocks or bonds or real estate. You have to have a mixed portfolio. But why aren't countries following this same basic rule?
That's a good question. I guess the approach is to make as much money as fast as possible and then figure out from that standpoint. So a lot of people who end up becoming involved in this industry, I mean, like the smallholders, don't really have much of a choice. Someone comes to them with a bunch of money and says, we'd like to convert your traditional forest into an oil palm plantation, or they aren't even given a choice. Someone comes along and starts clearing their forest and then they get offered a job, you know, to work on the plantation. They don't really have a choice in this a lot of the time. And so if the market does turn down, they're extra screwed, essentially.
I went to Malaysia before they planted their oil palm, but I've been to Costa Rica since their oil palm explosion. A lot of the expansion was in the early part of the 2000, around 2000 to 2002. I saw that they really ramped up quite rapidly in Costa Rica. I had a very different impression than I thought I would when I spoke to local people there. They had a generally positive view of the oil palm industry. Can you compare and contrast how Costa Rica's gone about planting their oil palm, what it's replaced, with the Malaysian and Indonesian experiences?
So what's happening in parts of Latin America, say Costa Rica, is pretty different from what's happened in Southeast Asia. So Southeast Asia, there's been a lot of expansion at the expense of natural forests. And a lot of these forests are quite high conservation value forests, maybe primary forests, but it's you know, quite good forests that's being converted for these oil palm plantations. In Costa Rica, which has very strict environmental laws, a lot of the expansion has happened more on agricultural land or on former plantations. So the oil palm plantations are much smaller. They also tend to have more corridors. So along rivers, you would have natural vegetation. So that would enable animals to migrate from one patch of forest to another. So while there are indeed, you know, these monoculture plantations in Costa Rica, which have their own issues with like water pollution and things like that, they are more ecologically friendly than what we generally see in Southeast Asia. Again, it's a matter of scale. It's a matter of following regulations, but they are different. So what's really interesting is looking forward is what will happen in Brazil. So on paper, Brazil has a very progressive biofuels law. And if you want your palm oil to qualify for this biodiesel law, you have to follow these rules. And the rules basically force a producer to establish oil palm plantations on non-forest land. And so the good news in Brazil is you have 100 million hectares of cattle pasture, which was long ago deforested, that could be converted for oil palm plantations. And so when you go from low productivity cattle pasture to oil palm, you're talking about increasing the carbon per hectare because you're going from grass that's burned every year or every couple of years to palm trees, which you know have wood, have vegetation. You have more forest function. You have much higher economic return. So you're going from something that's worth maybe $20 to $100 per hectare to a crop that's more like $3,000 to $20,000 a hectare. And you're looking at an industry that generates one job per 5 to 10 hectares versus one job per 5,000 hectares for cattle ranching. So if you're transitioning from cattle ranching to oil palm, there's actually some upside.
How about fruit? Because I know in Costa Rica, the United Fruit Company had a big stranglehold over that economy for several decades, and bananas were one of the things that the oil palm trees were replacing. And I know that one of the problems for bananas was that they were placing them in these plastic bags to keep them preserved, and then the turtle eggs and turtles would become endangered because of these plastic bags. And so it's really a question of what they're replacing, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And I'm not saying that oil palm is going to be perfect if it replaces these cattle ranches. It's still a monoculture. You still have issues with water pollution because there's all sorts of chemicals that most people dump on oil palm plantations. I mean, there are alternative methods for doing it. But in reality, the convention would be to use a lot of pesticides and herbicides and fertilizers. A lot of that will run off into rivers. You also have issues potentially with labor because these workers are in remote areas. They don't really have much options in terms of other forms of employment. You're also in an area where we currently have large-scale slave labor in these parts of Brazil. So from that standpoint, it's not really encouraging that labor is going to get better. I mean, theoretically, there's these laws that would govern these oil palm plantations in Brazil. But I think it's too early to say whether they will be enforced or what that will look like. The two major Brazilian producers right now, one of which is Agropalma, are actually very well respected for how they're doing it. They're doing it right in terms of, you know, what right looks like in the oil palm industry. But as the industry expands in Brazil, there are going to be other players entering the field, and who knows what it's going to look like.
Panggangan pilo Panggangan pilo di bawe bale nasi tujuhan nasi tujuhan.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with Rhett Butler, the founder of Manga Bay. It's an environmentally focused website. Rhett, can you talk for a moment about the roundtable on sustainable palm oil and the impact the group is having?
Yeah, so the roundtable on sustainable palm oil is a certification initiative that tries to incentivize producers to produce palm oil in a more socially and environmentally responsible way. The RSPO, as it's called, sets these criteria that are generated via this multi-stakeholder process. So you have environmental groups, you have human rights groups, you have producers, you have traders, you have retailers, you have buyers. All these people are coming together in a room and hammering out what the criteria look like. So the criteria at the end of the day don't please anyone. I mean, everyone has a criticism. You know, the environmentalists say that they're too weak. The producers say they're too strong. But the point is that there are some criteria to apply to this palm oil production. So if a company produces their palm oil under these criteria, then their palm oil is quote unquote RSPO certified and possibly can be sold at a premium.
Now, from a consumer standpoint, if consumers and listeners of this show, from a social justice and environmental activism standpoint, want to try to not buy palm oil or not include it in their diet, would they be able to eliminate it from their diet? How ubiquitous is this, Rhett?
I mean, according to WWF, which is a survey, is found in up to half or more than half of processed packaged foods in the grocery store. And so what's been interesting to see is that because palm oil is so cheap and other oil, the price of other vegetable oils is going up, there's been some curious replacements. So a few years ago, Cadbury replaced the cocoa butter in their chocolates with palm oil. So that was kind of interesting because they're taking out sort of a natural product that should be in there and replacing it with something that's much cheaper. And that, of course, triggered a huge backlash from environmentalists who are saying, well, you know, you're killing orangutans to make your chocolates that make you fat anyway. So that was kind of interesting to watch.
But did they keep it, or what kind of public, what was the outcome?
Well, it depends on the market. They changed the decision in New Zealand. I'm sure Cadbury in Indonesia probably uses palm oil. I mean, in terms of what people can do here, you know, if you're growing your own food, if you're buying from local markets, local producers, you're not going to encounter palm oil. The only place you really are going to encounter palm oil is in processed packaged foods. So, you know, if you're buying candy, if you're buying, you know, crackers, snack foods, things like that, that's where you're going to find the palm oil. It's not going to be buying your, you know, going to your local farmer's market. But if you do like those things, which is fine, and you want to try to encourage palm oil production to become less bad, you could look for companies or products that use RSPO certified palm oil. There are a lot of issues with the whole idea of the certified palm oil in terms of, are the standards strong enough? Are the standards enforced? But if you are buying things with palm oil and you show a preference for RSPO certified palm oil, it at least is sending a message to companies that people will actually care about this issue. So the whole emergence of this RSPO, you know, certification process has created a new lever for going after the issue. Because when there's no RSPO, there's nothing you could really do. I mean, you could say, I'm not going to eat any palm oil, but the reality is, this, you know, 3 billion people on Earth eat palm oil, so what impact are you going to have?
Critics also might say that, you know, this isn't ideal, but it's a lot better than drilling for oil in a lot of these fragile environments like Ecuador and Nigeria. You see some of these places that have just been devastated by oil exploitation and oil extraction. So having a firsthand view of a lot of the oil palm farming practices around the world, Rhett, how would you respond to that criticism? Like, this, is it the lesser of two evils, or do you see it as an equal in terms of a solution for our transportation needs down the road?
So if you're talking about, if you're comparing palm oil to traditional fossil fuel oil, it's a pretty complex comparison. A few years ago, everyone was talking about biofuels and how a lot of these, you know, crops, agro crops are going to become fuels of the future, but that's really died down lately. And palm oil has to be within a certain price range to actually be viable as a biofuel. Palm oil industry is really pushing for Europe to adopt, you know, palm oil for its biodiesel standards, but there's been a lot of backlash. So it's not really clear how it's going to fit in. And then palm oil is also up against sort of a time horizon where there's other alternative fuels that are coming on. So, you know, there's a company around here called Solazyme, which is producing essentially a palm oil mimic using algae. And you just feed the algae waste sugar products, and, you know, it's producing this oil. So then the other thing is that oil production is getting better in places. So with these horizontal drilling technologies and things like that, it's actually possible to extract oil in ways that are less damaging than it was 20 years ago with, you know, what's happened in Ecuador. So it's kind of hard to compare the two. They both have very serious downsides. And of course, when you burn either of these things, it generates, you know, carbon emissions. So that's, you know, that's the other side of this. It's not just the extraction process. It's the burning of the fuel.
The founder of Manga Bay, Rhett Butler. Rhett, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by the Grey Boy All-Stars, Jerry Garcia, and Nasib Muara Kwong. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.